right. Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor. This podcast is brought to you by Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Group, and we're glad you're here with us today. We had wanted to record our first episode of the 2022 season earlier in the year, but what with the Omicron variant wave and some heavy snows in DC, we were unfortunately delayed. But kick off the year we shall, and we're excited for many of the conversations that we have planned for this year. And of course, we'll also be watching for any new surprises or developments in the areas that we cover along the way. We thought it would be especially fun to have one of our friends from our policy resolution group to stop by and share what PRG is observing in terms of politics and policymaking. 2022, of course, is going to be a big year for this administration, not just with upcoming legislative and electoral challenges, but also with new major natural resources and environmental policy initiatives. So we're excited to welcome Christine Wyman from PRG, and we're also joined again by the wonderful Ann Navarro from our own practice group. That poster.
What?
That art on the back of your office.
Oh, my poster. That's a good story. It's interesting if you, I mean, we can just chat, but I think it is a good example of, I think, one of the things that we're here to discuss today, which is the implications of policy shifts and changes in the law that have been, you know, a hallmark of my entire career. Mm-hmm. Certainly when you're in the federal government, you get used to that. But as Daniel noted, there is a poster behind me in my office that has a picture of a young couple embracing, and it says mutated love on it. And also on the poster are some barrels marked as hazardous waste. And if you look very closely at the poster, you'll see that the young couple has some physical mutations, the implication being that they were affected by this radioactive waste. And the poster was given to me many, many years ago when I was at the Department of Justice after I litigated a case involving the proposed use of a site on public lands in Southern California for a low-level radioactive waste disposal facility. An outgoing administration had approved use of the site, kind of on a inauguration eve kind of timeline. So it was an expedited approval. It was very controversial. There were a number of stakeholders, environmental groups who were not pleased with the proposed use of the site. And yet the then Secretary of the Interior essentially afforded the private company the right to use the property for this disposal facility. And the next day, or very soon thereafter, the incoming Secretary of the Interior reversed that approval and decided that the site should not be used for a low-level radioactive waste disposal facility. And that ended up in litigation in actually a couple of different courts for a number of years. And this poster was on a billboard outside of federal offices in California protesting use of the site. So it's been a constant theme for me, this churn in policy, this churn in law, you know, that results in litigation and sometimes unpredictability.
Christine and Ann, I thought we could start just by looking back briefly over the year that was, what happened in 2021. And I think the biggest standout to me is the Biden administration's significant victory in the passage of the bipartisan infrastructure package, which is a broad funding bill that also has some new and interesting provisions for the regulated community. So, Christine, Ann, what kind of stands out to you about the infrastructure package and some of the achievements of 2021?
Great. Thanks, Daniel. And thanks for having me here. You know, when we look at the end of 2021, the infrastructure bill definitely is a crowning achievement for the Biden administration and Congress for really taking the next step towards clean energy transition specifically. I mean, if you look at what's being given to the Department of Energy alone on $62 billion in funding towards clean energy projects in forms of grants and research and development and loan programs, kind of an all of the aboard approach, to really taking clean energy to the next level. It's something that the administration and Congress can really hang their hats on. And I think that's really going to be part of the dominant conversation looking forward to 2022 as well as the rollout of that. And we can get more into that, you know, later. But the transition from the negotiations in Congress and then to the administration on implementation, I think, is a really important thing and something that we're following. And we'll be looking to see how Department of Energy and other Department of Transportation and other agencies are looking to roll those programs out. Obviously, what didn't happen at the end of 2021 was the Build Back Better Act, the reconciliation and kind of, soft funding piece of the president's infrastructure plan, still on the table. And people are still looking towards, whether or not that's something that can be put together for this year. And even this week alone, there's speculation of whether or not it can be pared down on social programs to provide a vehicle for what some people see as consensus on the climate provisions there. So, you know, it's a little too early to see what's going to come out of those conversations. There's a lot on Congress's plate this week and next. Voting Rights Act, dealing with filibuster reform, things like that. And we'll have the State of the Union coming up. But, we'll see what kind of compromise packages, if they do arise, and whether or not there's concessions made for Manchin to finally get his vote. So those things are still on the table.
That's a great overview, Christine. And, I've always thought that our friends in PRG were just generally much braver than the rest of us. And on the legal side, y'all aren't afraid to watch the sausage being made. And we just take refuge in our copies of the Federal Register. So let's drill down for a couple of minutes on, you talked about some of the big initiatives that agencies are having to put together to actually implement the bipartisan infrastructure package. I know that there are provisions related to the hydrogen industry, CCUS. Can you and talk about some of what we see there in terms of some of those specifics that might affect some of our friends?
Sure, I can get us started. Looking at the Department of Energy, I think that's really where a lot of the focus is right now. As I mentioned, it's $62 billion that have been given to them. And some of the key programs that we're seeing there relate to hydrogen, carbon capture, transmission, batteries, storage, and things like that. Just last week, the Department of Energy announced the hiring of nearly 1,000 people that they're trying to bring on board to actually implement all of these programs. It's such a monumental kind of task of bringing in and onboarding that many people. I think it really demonstrates kind of the scope of the programs and the types of activities that they're really trying to scale up to, but also that this is not going to be kind of an overnight type thing as they're looking at really bringing in the resources and the people to be able to implement these programs for the long term.
Christine, if I could just jump in on that, sorry to interrupt you, but, just the notion of hiring 1,000 people just like makes me unsettled. I mean, unless the Department of Energy has some sort of special expedited hiring authority and process that I'm not familiar with, which it may. But hiring people into the federal government is complicated and time consuming. For example, I think the Army Corps of Engineers some years back even got some sort of special type of hiring authority so they could try to staff up when a lot of these big dollars come their way. So, it'll be interesting to watch and see how fast they can make that happen.
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, the challenge there is real. And if you look also at the fact that they're looking for people with really specialized expertise, coupling that with the administrative challenges of hiring within the federal government. This is, the HR side alone is going to, in bringing on those people is going to be quite tremendous. So not to mention then trying to roll out all these infrastructure bill programs.
And you can imagine that those are many of the same individuals that the regulated community also wants to see in their workforces as well, to take advantage of the very programs that DOE wants to roll out. And I also think, and I wonder if Anne, you have any thoughts on this, when you have so many new individuals, you've got to onboard them, not just to the specific program that they're going to be administering, but to, administrative decision-making and the parameters of that, making sure that you've adequately considered options. So I think that will be interesting because I'm sure that both components of the bipartisan infrastructure package and then whatever we see from Build Back Better are going to be challenged in the courts, not just the statutes themselves, but also some of the programs that end up implementing them. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Daniel. And I think you're absolutely right. It'll be interesting to see where DOE puts all these new hires, whether they actually put them kind of into the new programs or whether they bring more senior people into those programs who have experience and then put new hires somewhere else to backfill those people. Because you're exactly right about the federal reviews. I mean, this money, for the most part, can't be distributed by the federal government without, for example, going through environmental review under the National Environmental Policy Act, even the Endangered Species Act, or the National Historic Preservation Act. And having that done properly and well is going to be critical to the success of not only distributing the money, but ultimately having these projects implemented. So DOE also has to be thinking about how to get the right people in place in order to do that. And some folks might think, well, you know, these projects, everybody's going to love these renewable projects, clean energy projects. You know, so yeah, they have to go through the environmental review process, but nobody's too worried. But you know, as we know, there are folks who dislike every project ever built for whatever reason. And not only is it critical for DOE to comply with the law generally, but certainly making sure they do it carefully in order to support the success of the programs is critical.
That makes sense. And, you know, a couple of programs that Department of Energy is looking at implementing relate to hydrogen and carbon capture. And to your point, those are two different types of technologies that there isn't universal support for, but there is kind of a recognition that some form of these technologies will need to be able to support the energy economy in order to really achieve some of the goals that the Biden administration and others are floating around about 2050 net zero goals. And so hydrogen and carbon capture, Daniel, to your point on some of the specifics that were included in the IIJA, I think are two programs that really got significant attention and that people are really excited about. On the hydrogen side, there's hydrogen hubs, about $8 billion, I think, for looking at four regional hydrogen hubs to bring in the hydrogen production, transportation, and end use. You know, that's a lot of different stakeholders. If you think about what it goes into to, you know, building out the hydrogen economy, and they're looking for applications for, you know, bringing together those types of parties and unique applications for end use that's really going to be the highest and best use for hydrogen. And so that's something that I think people are really excited about, as well as some grant funding for electrolysis, which you may know is a method for producing hydrogen using electricity. And if that electricity is you know, produced from renewables like solar or wind or even nuclear energy, you can produce hydrogen with zero carbon emissions, either from both the point of production as well as the upstream energy use. And so that's something that people are really excited about and that DOE is going to be rolling out. All of that is going to be done in conjunction with, I don't want to call it a rulemaking, but a determination by the Department of Energy in conjunction with EPA on what is the carbon intensity level for the hydrogen that's going to be required for eligibility in these programs. I think a lot of people are watching that that standard that Department of Energy is going to be coming out with. It's set right now in the statute at 2 kilograms of CO2, but at the point of production. But, you know, DOE and EPA have the authority to reduce that as technology advances. And so the process by which EPA and DOE go about setting that, as well as the standard, is something that people are watching pretty closely. So those are some programs in hydrogen that people are excited about. And carbon capture also has a lot of funding, both on direct air capture, with carbon capture hubs and industrial emissions capture, and funding for EPA to scale up their permitting program for sequestration. That's kind of been a little bit of a delay for some of these CCUS projects, is where to be able to put the carbon that is actually sequestered. And the permitting program over at EPA, as they build that out, is one of the things that people are grappling with, the regulatory side of things. And so that will infuse more funding into EPA to be able to stand up that program.
Well, speaking of where to put it, once you've got a regulatory program, the infrastructure bill, you know, had, at least in my world, a really significant provision about carbon capture, because of course there's so many folks interested in permanent carbon sequestration, but kind of missing from that discussion about where to put it has been public lands, you know, onshore public lands, which are vast in the West, and offshore public lands on the outer continental shelf. And it was interesting because I know there was kind of chatter out in the, you know, out in the world that there was already authority under the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act for the Department of the Interior to allow permanent carbon sequestration on the Outer Continental Shelf. I don't think that was ever the case. I think it was a misunderstanding and misperception. But in any event, Congress has now solved that problem by specifically amending the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act to allow permanent carbon sequestration on the Outer Continental Shelf. Congress also amended the Ocean Dumping Act to exclude CO2 from carbon sequestration. So there's now also not that lingering question about whether the Ocean Dumping Act would apply to permanent sequestration, carbon sequestration on the Outer Continental Shelf. So that's a big deal to amend the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act to allow a totally new use of the Outer Continental Shelf. It was amended, as everyone probably knows, some years ago to allow wind. And then this is another one that really opens it up for additional uses. Now, it can't be allowed right away. The Act gives the Department of the Interior a year to promulgate regulations that essentially stand up a program. I think that's going to be a heavy lift to do it in a year. I know there have been interagency studies about offshore sequestration, but I'm not aware of kind of any serious development of what a leasing program offshore and regulatory program offshore would look like. So that's a pretty heavy lift for Interior, and I'm sure they're going to be grappling with some really big questions, like, you know, how much, what should the financial return to the United States be for these leases? You know, for oil and gas, they look at terms, you know, and annual rentals and things like that. But when you're talking about a permanent offshore use, the way you approach the financial return to the taxpayer for use of this public resource is obviously very different. So they're going to have to think through all of that. They're going to have to think through existing leases. I can imagine there are existing lessees who think it would be a great idea just to tack this on to their existing leases. But there will also be many stakeholders who think that's a bad idea because they obviously never had a chance to bid on that geographic area to use it for permanent sequestration. So I think there's going to be a ton of issues. Obviously, any particular project is going to require review under the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers may also have a role to play in terms of fixing structures to the seabed floor if that's what's required. So I think it's a big deal, and it'll be interesting to watch and engage as Interior develops the program.
So if our time on this podcast and our conversation so far is any indication, it seems like we could spend the bulk of this year just digesting what was in the infrastructure package, right? And so I think we'll definitely come back to that, and we're going to have Christine back on to clue us in as to what's going on with hydrogen sometime later in the year. Christine, briefly, you mentioned that there is a little bit of a path forward for the Build Back Better Act, centered on maybe narrowing the scope of BBB and maybe some agreement between this administration and Senator Manchin on climate provisions. And I know that, I mean, by the time that this podcast actually hits the internet, we may be looking at something totally different, but I'd love to know what, for right now, those climate provisions are that seem to be providing a little bit of a path forward, or at least some light at the end of the tunnel for BBB.
sure. And, you know, these things are moving so quickly. I feel like we need like a timestamp or something like that, or like a disclaimer on the podcast for the recording date. But, you know.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, we'd be like recording on Joe Manchin's boat and we could just ask him.
But don't we all want to be just a fly on Joe Manchin's boat to hear how these conversations are going? But, you know, Daniel, you mentioned that Manchin had, Senator Manchin had suggested that there was some sort of agreement on the climate provisions. And, you know, there has been a lot of work on those. When we look at what's included in Build Back Better, a lot of it is tax incentives and grants and funding type proposals. You know, there's about $320 billion in expanded tax credits for residential and utility scale renewable energy transmission, electric vehicles, and clean energy manufacturing. There's $105 billion to boost the resilience for effects from climate change, from like wildfires and droughts and things like that. There's investments in supply chains for renewable energy technology. So if you're looking at batteries and things like that, and domestic manufacturing of EVs and solar panels and those types of things. And there's about $20 billion to incentivize the government to purchase cutting edge energy type technology. So, you know, a lot of money is included in there towards climate provisions. We also have the methane fee, which is a fee that would be imposed on those in the natural gas value chain that have methane emissions above a certain threshold for what they're already reporting. So it starts, I believe, at about $1,500 and ramps up to about $1,500 fee for these producers, but it's a kind of a delta, like a threshold. Like if you're under a certain amount, then you would not have any sort of fee imposed on you. But if you're above that, then you would. And that actually has evolved over time pretty significantly from, you know, different types of how you calculate the fee, but that also it's only now imposed on those who do emit over a certain level. And all of that, from what Manchin has suggested, does have some consensus. Now, he hasn't been specific as to which of the specific provisions he's defining as the climate provisions, or some things are in or some things are out. We know that he still does have some, or we've, you know, there's reports that he still does have some concern about the scope of the EV credits and the amount there. So that might be something that we see some changes around the edges. But, you know, I think the scale and the types of provisions that are in there, there's some consensus at least as to what those look like. We're starting to see some encouragement from House members, House Democratic members, trying to get the Senate to move on these, recognizing that, you know, if there is consensus on these climate provisions, let's go ahead and scale back some of the other social type programs and get moving on that, because they do see this vehicle as like their chance to really advance the clean energy transition and providing more incentives there. And, you know, addressing climate change is really going to be a big part of their reelection campaigns, and they need to move something there. And so it's against the backdrop of the midterm elections later this year that they're really trying to advance these types of things. But as for now, you know, this week does seem like it's a little bit of a quieter week. We're waiting to see whether or not there will be some sort of scaled back proposals. But I think, you know, general consensus is that the Democrats, given this is an election year, really are looking to do something in the name of reconciliation. And, you know, there's a lot of people that hope that if there is consensus on the climate side, that they'll be able to advance that.
And that seems like that would be a fresh legislative accomplishment to take around the country and sort of barnstorm for continued control. I think that's one of the other key things we'll be watching. With, I think in my recent memory, midterm elections for new presidents typically flip one or both of the legislative branches. So it'll be interesting to see if that happens. And I imagine that our PRG friends have that, are sort of laser focused on that. Can you give us sort of like a, you know, bullet points of what we should be watching as we go into November 2022? And then, we'll send it to Anne for some, thoughts about what we should be watching for on the policy side.
you know, not surprising. We've seen a lot of House Democrats starting to announce their retirements. I think we're in 22 or 24 have announced thus far. A lot of those are in relatively safe districts. But, you know, I think watching the movement there on retirements and how that plays out, and whether or not they can really, you know, bring home this win on climate is going to be helpful for a lot of Democrats that are really, you know, building a platform on climate change. So.
And what should we be looking for, you know, as we're kind of down to the wire on our time today? But, you know, in addition to looking at politics in 2022, I think we've already seen this administration signal a lot about what they want to do in 2022 on in terms of rulemaking, in terms of enforcement. It seems like over the course of 2021, for the most part, the agencies, this administration was able to get its individuals into the agencies, into their political appointments position. So I know that you and I have been talking about some new developments with NEPA, some new developments with WOTUS. What should we be watching for?
Well, I think there's a whole menu of things that are teed up that are potentially pretty significant rulemakings, in particular in the kind of natural resources and general environmental space. Some that are ongoing, but a number that the administration has said will have second phases, and the second phase will be, you know, more substantive and far reaching than the first phase of the rulemaking will be. And putting it in the context of kind of Christine's more political world, it will certainly be interesting to see what they decide to take on prior to the midterms. I mean, there's always, you know, that kind of dead zone before an election where agencies try not to do anything that may be perceived as controversial or alienating.
Nothing, you know, too aggressive.
Important voters. You know, I guess given the nature of these midterms, I guess I'm expecting them to extend that period a little bit so that it, you know, reaches farther earlier in 2022. So, for example, if you look at the reach of the Clean Water Act and the definition of waters of the U.S., which defines the geographic scope of the act, obviously that has been going back and forth and heavily litigated for decades. And the most recent redefinition of that, you know, is currently in the rulemaking process. But the current rulemaking effort would take the definition basically back to the pre-President Obama, pre-2015 era. So while a lot of folks don't like it, it wouldn't really break much new ground, even though there will be people who challenge it and certainly contest that it's allowable under the Clean Water Act. So, and EPA has said that they're going to do a second phase of a WOTUS rulemaking, presumably to change the definition in more substantive and complex ways, perhaps in ways that we haven't seen before over the course of the last, you know, 3-4 rulemakings and implementation of WOTUS. So, you know, that can be somewhat of a lightning rod. And so I guess I wonder whether we'll see phase two of that in 2022, or whether that will await post-election efforts. And there are a number of examples like that in the ESA context, the National Environmental Policy Act. You know, we haven't talked about oil and gas, but obviously oil and gas development on public lands is still very much on the table. The most recent version of the Build Back Better bill that I've seen retains some provisions that would increase the cost of oil and gas development on public lands, for example, increasing royalties, rentals, imposing some new fees. Some of those things the Interior Department can do under its own authority in a rulemaking, and it doesn't need congressional action. So it'll be interesting to see whether they advance those rulemakings. They have certainly said they're going to. I think the question will be timing and whether they want to wait and see if any element of this stuff passes Congress, because then they wouldn't have to do that hard work of going through a rulemaking. I think also just one more thing I'll say in terms of how policy is playing out at the agencies, in addition to the efforts to kind of take a fresh look at and diminish the role of the oil and gas program on public lands, which is the stated goal. I mean, the BLM director's stated goal is to have renewables essentially satisfy the agency's energy mandate and really pivot from oil and gas. And there has been a huge shift in resources at the agencies to really focus on permitting renewable projects. So as that continues to play out, it will be interesting to see what form that takes, and whether it's clearly at the expense of ongoing oil and gas development, and then also what it results in. You know, are they going to get new wind projects and solar projects permitted? Are they going to be able to really make these reviews more efficient?
One other thing that is also lurking in the back of my mind, I know in the back of some of our colleagues who focus on the Clean Air Act, is a pretty significant case before the Supreme Court, West Virginia versus EPA, which is all about EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gases through 111D of the Clean Air Act. And so that's another thing that's going to affect this administration's approach to climate. And so it'll be really interesting to see in the mix of, climate change oriented funding and policymaking, how the Clean Air Act and how the Supreme Court really steps in to have its own say. So that's all going to be stuff that we're watching this year. I think it'll be a pretty interesting year. So thank you, Christine. Thank you, Anne. And thank you, dear listener, for spending a little time with us today. We are looking forward to what this year has in store and our ability to share that with you. So subscribe if you haven't subscribed, leave us a review, and we'll talk to you soon.